This is the State of Things from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Adam Hochberg, and today for Frank Statio. President Obama has named his pick for the Supreme Court, Merrick Garland. The D.C. Circuit Chief Judge now awaits Senate confirmation, and he may wait a long time because Republican Senate leaders said even before Garland was named that they're not going to hold hearings on the president's choice. Meanwhile, Hillary Clinton and Donald Trump won North Carolina's presidential primary yesterday. While 40% of the state's Democratic voters supported Bernie Sanders, the Vermont senator's path to the nomination is getting increasingly narrow. Meanwhile, as Mr. Trump continues to triumph, the field of GOP contenders shrank once again as Marco Rubio suspended his campaign. We're talking politics today, and joining me first is Jeff Bennett, the Washington reporter for Time Warner News. Welcome back to the show, Jeff.
Thanks for having me, Adam.
So, Jeff, you've been following the Supreme Court nomination process. Tell us, who is Merrick Garland? What do we know about him?
So Merrick Garland, as you said, he's the chief judge of D.C.'s Court of Appeals. He's a moderate, and he's also a well-known and well-regarded figure here on Capitol Hill. He was actually passed over for a spot on the Supreme Court twice before. The last time the slot went to Justice Elena Kagan. He's also 63 years old, which makes him the oldest person to be nominated to the court in more than 40 years. And he served under former President Bill Clinton in the Justice Department, and that's where he led the prosecution of Oklahoma City bomber Timothy McVeigh and Unabomber Ted Kaczynski. And both he and the president spoke at length about that experience today in the Rose Garden. But, you know, I tell you, what came across to me the most was that he presented himself as a modest family man. He teared up at times, saying the nomination was the honor of his life. And you could tell the pick is really designed to make the GOP break their vow to not hold hearings or a vote for President Obama's nominee. And, of course, they've been saying that well before Merrick Garland was announced as the president's choice. But so far, it appears that Republicans are really sort of impervious to the pressure. Mitch McConnell was on the floor of the Senate today, and he said it's about principles, not about a person. McConnell says he's not even going to meet with Mr. Garland. And so at this point, it appears that this nomination is stalling.
So Garland is somebody who Republican senators have praised in the past, and the president in his remarks this morning called for them to act and act soon. Let's listen.
I have fulfilled my constitutional duty. Now it's time for the Senate to do theirs. Presidents do not stop working in the final year of their term. Neither should a senator.
So, Jeff, is this just a dead end in the Senate, or can you imagine a scenario where there'd be enough pressure on Senate leaders that they might be forced to act?
Well, the White House is hoping that Republican senators will break under pressure. They point to public opinion polls that show the American public is in favor of the president's nominee at least getting a fair hearing. But today, the Senate Republican campaign operation put out a statement that said, quote, Garland is a liberal and activist and one of Obama's most reliable allies in the judicial system. So, judging the tenor of that statement, you can imagine how this fight is going to play out over the coming weeks. And I say that the Senate is going to take a break for 2 weeks. So Mr. Garland is supposed to be on the Hill tomorrow to meet with a few senators. And then beyond that, they'll be in their home states where they'll imagine hear from the public.
So this will become an issue in the presidential election, undoubtedly. So let's turn to the presidential election and the primary results last night. On the Democratic side first, Hillary Clinton had a setback earlier this month in Michigan, and last night she seemed to overcome that. She was dominant in North Carolina, Florida, Ohio, Illinois. What do you think sparked this resurgence?
Well, you know, it's fascinating, right? She really extended her lead with the wins in Florida, Ohio, Illinois, and North Carolina. The win in Ohio was significant because she won with a relatively huge margin, and it was supposed to be a close state. But, you know, it was also an important moral victory by denying Bernie Sanders a major upset there. So at this point, it's clear that Hillary Clinton will be the Democratic nominee. She started her victory speech last night explaining the delegate math that more or less makes her nomination a sure thing. Now, talking about delegate math is probably not the most inspirational way to start a victory speech, but it really is the most important part of her victory because, Sanders would really have to start demolishing her lead and not just in the races where he's expected to do well, but in Clinton's home state of New York, which votes next, in Connecticut, and in Maryland. Maryland, by the way, has a heavily black primary electorate. And there's no sign at this point that he has anywhere near the amount of support he would need to make that happen. So, you know, Senator Sanders didn't get his upsets last night, and it really hurt him, although I do not think he will drop out anytime soon. He has a message that is resonating with people. He has a ton of money. So I do expect to see him stick around at least until June, as did Hillary Clinton two cycles ago when she ran against now President Barack Obama.
Well, let's bring in our political junkie, Ken Rudin. Sorry, Ken, I called you the political jumpy, but that would be appropriate.
Adam, I am kind of jumpy these days.
I think you probably are. Yeah,
yes,
good to hear from you, Ken.
How are you? Long time no speak.
Good to talk with you. Well, do you agree? Is Bernie Sanders, are his hopes dashed now? Any possibility that we're going to see Bernie Sanders on the stage in Philadelphia claiming the Republican nomination? I'm sorry, the Democratic nomination?
Well, I mean, 2016, if it's shown us anything, there are a lot of things that are possible that were not possible 6 months ago, as Bernie Sanders said last night, and he said this so many times. He said 10 months ago, we were 3% in the polls. And that's true. 10 months ago, he was 3% in the polls. And it's true that last week he had a very impressive surprise victory in Michigan, even though it was 50-48. It was not expected at all. He was trailing in the polls by almost 20 points in every survey I saw. But having said that, even with a win in Michigan last week, which came at the same day that Hillary Clinton won Mississippi, Hillary Clinton got by far the most delegates that night because she swept the Mississippi and basically broke even in Michigan. So, Bernie Sanders, he says he'll be in to the end. He says he'll fight all the way to the convention in Philadelphia. But he knows that, you know, the math is against him. Time is against him. And he can't just win or win narrowly or come close to Hillary Clinton. He's going to have blowout victories. And if you look at the terrain that's coming up, and if you look at what the Democratic elite and establishment is talking about, I don't see where that path is. As you said earlier, he does have the money. He does have the fervent support. He has started a mini revolution in the fact that he has moved the Democratic Party on certain issues that Hillary Clinton was not ready to move to. But she has moved in that direction. And right now, it's just very hard to see that path to Philadelphia.
So we have one nomination almost sewn up on the Democratic side. Ken, I'm just going to ask an open-ended question. What on earth is going to happen on the Republican side? Another big night of victories for Donald Trump, including here in North Carolina. Marco Rubio, only a few weeks ago, he was the hope for Republicans who wanted to stop Trump. He was on magazine covers. Republican leaders were rushing to endorse him. Now, last night, he suspended his campaign. Ken, you know, political downfalls aren't anything new, but Senator Rubio, he never really had his upfall in the first place.
That's true, and yet, you know, once upon a time, if it wasn't Jeb Bush, or in addition to Jeb Bush, he was the dream alternative, the establishment alternative. I don't even know what the establishment means anymore, but he was going to be the guy, the non-Donald Trump nominee. He was elected in 2010 with support from the Tea Party. He had a good rapport with establishment and moderate and centrist Republicans. He was the dream candidate who was going to beat Hillary Clinton in November, but he never took off. The fact is, he won Minnesota. He won Puerto Rico. And as you say, in yesterday's Florida primary, he finished a very poor second to Donald Trump. He may have had all these endorsements in all these states, but so did Jeb Bush. And where is Jeb Bush these days? So it's just remarkable. We talk about how improbable this Donald Trump surge has been, and it's been going on for months. And every time we think, okay, this time he says something so incendiary that he's going to be stopped, or this time he crosses the line, it doesn't happen and he keeps on winning. If you think of all the stop Trump efforts that we've seen over the past couple of weeks, led in part by Mitt Romney and other Republicans, it doesn't affect him at all. And the fact is that other than Ohio, which John Kasich won yesterday, Donald Trump had a clear sweep. So I don't see any pathway, and I don't think how he's stopped until he gets to the convention in Cleveland.
And Jeff, what are you hearing in Washington? What do you hear from the so-called Republican establishment, or what's left of it?
The so-called Washington establishment, or the Washington regulars up here, say that they probably don't say publicly, is that Donald Trump is costing them a lot of money. You know, there are a lot of people here in sort of the business of Washington that make their money, as analysts, as strategists, the people who actually wrote the playbook, the political playbook that Donald Trump is tearing up. So that's one of the things that's really fueling the anger to undo the success of a Donald Trump. And to Ken's point earlier about Marco Rubio, Marco Rubio never really had a base of support. He kind of tried to appeal to everyone and ended up being nobody's choice. And if you look at the map last night of Florida, I mean, he won his neighborhood where he lives, so his family and friends voted for him. But, he obviously lost his state. And one of the reasons he did was because his campaign made a decision early on to have a national media strategy. BuzzFeed News has this really compelling story about how at one point his campaign was coordinating his stump speeches with Fox News so that they could get the most exposure on national or cable TV. But they didn't have a ground game. And then here comes Donald Trump, who's obviously a better-known figure because of his reality TV show background and all that, and it really usurped their strategy. So that's kind of what undid Marco Rubio. But, he's 44 years old. He definitely has a career left in politics, although obviously not in this political election.
Ken, quickly, the question I keep coming back to is, if not Trump, who? Who do they go to in a contested convention, if not Donald Trump?
Well, that's what's driving establishment again. That's what's driving the establishment nuts, because if there will be an alternative to Donald Trump, it's hard to make the case that it's John Kasich. It's nice to win Ohio, but by my count, there are 47, 48, no, 49 other states. So you can't just win your home state and expect to do well at the convention. If the alternative to Trump is Ted Cruz, he is far from the most likable, popular Republican in town. Most of the members of his own party in the Senate despise him, and yet he's trying to sell himself as the conservative alternative to Donald Trump.
Political junkie Ken Rudin will stay with us as we talk about North Carolina politics. Jeff Bennett for The Washington Reporter from Time Warner News. Thanks, Jeff. You're listening to The State of Things from North Carolina Public Radio, a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. This is The State of Things, broadcasting from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Adam Hochberg, in today for Frank Statio. North Carolinians cast their ballots yesterday, and we're taking a look at the results. I'm joined today by political experts. Susan Roberts is a professor of political science at Davidson College. She joins us today from WDAV in Davidson. Welcome back, Susan.
Thanks. It's good to be with you.
And Jarvis Hall is here in the studio with us, a political science professor at North Carolina Central University. Welcome back also, Jarvis.
How you doing, Adam?
Good to see you. And political junkie Ken Rudin is still with us from Washington, D.C. Jarvis, we saw strong voter turnout yesterday in North Carolina, and it was the first time that voters had to show their IDs under the new state voter ID law. Any indication of how that played out? Did you hear any issues with the IDs at the polls?
I heard some reports some college students had some problems at the polls. As many of your listeners may know, with the new voter ID law here in North Carolina, IDs that are issued by college campuses are not acceptable as a government-issued ID. And so that's problematic for many students at both private and public institutions. And so there were some problems. There were a number of provisional ballots that had to be cast because they did not have the appropriate ID, which is a new amendment to the ID law. And so it'll be interesting to see what happens, though, when many of the campuses are not on spring break and we can see the full impact that the ID law may have.
Yeah, NC Central's on break now. I know UNC's on spring
break
now.
Yeah.
So, yeah, it's going to be the fall election before we really know with the students.
Right. I think the problem is really going to be amplified as we go into the fall.
Now, for this primary, North Carolina moved the primary date up. It used to be in May. Now the primary is in March. And Susan, the legislature was hoping that would make North Carolina more of a player in the presidential campaign. Did that work?
Well, I don't think it made us a player in terms of the delegates, but I think it's been overlooked in terms of what it represents for the demographics in North Carolina. And what we're going to see play out in terms of the politics of race, which has been sharply divided with both Bernie Sanders and Donald Trump. I mean, the angry white male vote is not one that we've seen that much in North Carolina. I will point out, too, that they had the chance to move. They moved the primary, but they also had the chance to change to winner take all, and they chose not to do that. I think that might make a difference. Had it been winner take all, we would have received a little more attention. I guess I'm not, I think we had the Ohio and Florida did eclipse North Carolina, but I don't think it was insignificant for a number of reasons.
So we're talking about the way the delegates are allocated for the on the Republican side. Some states,
yes, sure. Yeah,
some
on
states,
the Republican
if you
side.
Win, if you win the majority or even the plurality of the vote, you get all the state's delegates. But in
sure,
North Carolina,
think,
they were awarded proportionally.
On the Democratic side, proportionally. I think what happens, no matter what the delegate count is between Sanders and Clinton, you get the bragging rights to say, I won these states. And Bernie Sanders has used that. Hillary Clinton has used that. And I think that's what winning the state means for the Democratic side and the Republican side, given some of them, too, were winner-take-all. But you have bragging rights. If you say Hillary Clinton won all five states, it's much better than counting up the delegates for whether or not she's going to win the nomination outright, which, you know, I would say that she is. And I don't think it's going to go to a brokered convention, but I'm sticking my neck out there for the Republicans.
Well, how do you think it'll end up then, if not a brokered convention?
Well, I think you're having people, it's going really from resistance for Trump to kind of resignation. I mean, when Paul Ryan says that he will back Donald Trump if he's the nominee, I think that says something about, do we need to have that dangerous a convention in which you have the playoff between what is legal and what is political? And politically, it would be very incendiary for the Republicans to let it go to a brokered convention. I'm not entirely convinced that we're going to have smooth sailing. But I don't think Kasich is going to be the one that can be the compromise candidate.
So, Ken, if we do not have a brokered convention, if we end up with Donald Trump as the nominee, is every race in the country then become about Donald Trump? Is it possible for Republican candidates like Governor McCrory or Senator Burr here in North Carolina to even separate themselves from Donald Trump at that point?
No, it's probably not going to be easy. And, of course, Donald Trump will make the argument that because of his candidacy, far more voters are coming out in Republican primaries than ever before. And conversely, the Democratic primary vote has been much lower than in previous cycles, certainly much lower than 2008. So while the Democrats are licking their lips at the thought of the prospect of running against Donald Trump, the fact is that there are a lot of Republicans in the Senate, maybe Rob Portman in Ohio, Mark Kirk in Illinois, Kelly Ayotte in New Hampshire, Rod Johnson in Wisconsin. There are a lot of Republicans, senators, who are at risk of getting defeated, and they fear a top of a ticket led by Donald Trump. But at the same time, there are a lot, and I don't know how many, what a lot means, but there are a lot of voters who are just tired of everything, including Democrats, who say that Donald Trump is offering something that no other candidate is offering. And so Donald Trump, to decide right now that Donald Trump is a sure loser or a sure drag on the Republican brand in November is a little premature, I think.
Jarvis, how do you think a Trump candidacy would play out in North Carolina, especially in terms of the down ballot races?
Well, I think especially at the for the governor's race and the race for U.S. Senate, Richard Burr's seat, I think the opponents on the Democratic side would certainly try to link the Republican candidates to Donald Trump in some way. Pat McCrory, as I understand it, has not endorsed a candidate on the presidential level. So that opens himself up, I think, to be linked to Donald Trump because he hasn't said that he's against Donald Trump. And so I suspect that Roy Cooper has already talked about the fact that North Carolina is better than the politics that we're seeing on a national level. So he's trying to make the case that we don't want to have a Donald Trump type campaign, and certainly we don't want to have a Donald Trump like candidate in McCrory. And I'm not saying McCrory is like that, but he would try to taint the McCrory campaign with Donald Trump. And I think the same thing may happen on the for the race for the U.S. Senate.
Yeah, you know, we used to see that happen the other way in North Carolina. For years, you would see Republicans try to link Democratic candidates in the state.
Right, try to nationalize.
Yeah, whether it was George McGovern or Walter Mondale or Michael Dukakis, they would try to link whoever was running for, you could be running for agriculture commissioner or labor commissioner, and they'd link you to George McGovern.
My, how things have changed.
Yep, absolutely. Susan, let's, go ahead, Ken.
Can I just throw in a little North Carolina historical perspective there? As everybody remembers, in 1972, when Jesse Helms was a right-wing commentator running for the Senate, not thought to have a chance, his Democratic opponent turned out to be Nick Galifianakis, the former congressman whose name was so long you needed two buttons to have his name on everything. But Galifianakis was portrayed as a George McGovern clone, and that allowed Jesse Helms to win the election as the first Republican since Reconstruction. Similarly, in 1984, you mentioned Walter Mondale. I mean, that was the classic Jesse Helms, Jim Hunt Senate race, where Jim Hunt was beloved at home, very, very popular, but he was tied to the very unpopular Walter Mondale, and that also helped Jesse Helms get that reelection in 84.
Yeah, I think it was in the 84 election when Walter Mondale came to North Carolina, and the only Democrat who would appear with him was Jim Graham, the agriculture commissioner. Hunt was not there. None of the other candidates, Democratic candidates, were present. So it would be interesting if Donald Trump holds events in North Carolina, and we'd expect North Carolina to be a swing state again. So it's likely we would see Donald Trump in North Carolina. It'd be interesting to take a head count of who's going to be with him. Aside from the Trump aspect of the race, Susan, what else should we look for in the McCrory-Cooper gubernatorial race?
Well, I think that we already heard Cooper say last night, do you want a McCrory-Trump ticket? And I think he's going to make that part of his platform. I listened to Deborah Ross and what she was saying last night in a very spirited victory speech. She was going at it much the same way as Hagan in terms of North Carolina values. It was echoes of the last convention. And I think Ross and Burr, that race is going to be as expensive as the last time around, and it will be nationalized, I believe, because of the Democratic Senatorial Campaign Committee, Emily's List, other groups are making that a real priority for that seat. And I've said this several times, but when you think of it, there are about eight seats for nationally that are really contested, but the Democrats are only defending 10 seats in the U.S. Senate, and the Republicans are defending 24. And I think there is a lot of room, given that there's a lot of volatility and the Trump factor. We just don't know what could happen in those other races besides the just seven or eight that are listed as, competitive.
And the other I'm sorry, go ahead.
Yeah. Well, and I think also we need to think about the degree to which we've had. I tried to look this morning because I thought it might tell us something about North Carolina. I couldn't find out anything about the drop-off between the presidential race and the Republican primary and the Democratic primary. What happened down ballot? Partisans and primaries usually vote all the way, but I don't know what happened this time because, as you just said, Trump is bringing voters to the Republican primary, not bringing voters to the Republican Party.
Yeah, one of the things that that the legislature did is I think they removed the straight party option from the fall ballot also.
Mm-hmm. And that's important. I mean, we were one of the last few states, and I can't remember how many, that still had the straight ticket ballot.
One of the things when you talk about the Burr race, and I'm doing these numbers in my head, so don't hold me to exactly these numbers, but going back, you know, like 30 years, there have only been two senators in North Carolina who have ever won their reelection. And, you know, out of the 9 or 10 senators that have been elected during that time, there's only two that have ever been reelected, and that's Jesse Helms and Richard Burr. And otherwise, there's a long list of one-term senators in North Carolina, John Edwards, Locke Faircloth, Kay Hagan, Elizabeth Dole. So North Carolina does not particularly like to reelect their senators. Do you think, Jarvis, that Richard Burr has sort of that Jesse Helms Teflon quality and can manage to get reelected now to a third term?
Well, I'm not so sure. I think, again, what's going on at the top of the ballot, at the top of the ticket, if Donald Trump is indeed the nominee, I think, too, with somewhat of a vulnerable candidate running for governor, that Burr himself is very vulnerable. And I think he's been identified as such by those publications that make those kinds of designations. And he has a very formidable opponent in Deborah Ross. And so I think that this is going to be a very expensive campaign. Just as Susan said, it's going to be one that receives some national attention because, again, North Carolina is a swing state. So I think he's going to have to pull out all stops in order to keep that seat.
Now, Deborah
and
Ross
Burr is is no Helms. You know, they're really very different in how they approach the party and the visibility that they have.
I was going to say that Deborah Ross, before she was in the state legislature, she was the state director of the ACLU. So I would imagine that the campaign ads, the 30-second campaign ads, just write themselves on a lot of the issues that the ACLU probably was involved with in that time. How do you think that would play in your part of the state, Susan?
Well, I think that that might be something that's fairly persuasive, maybe not in Mecklenburg County, because I think that's where we're still an urban center as some of the other urban centers, and I think they're more liberal. But I think that in the Research Triangle, that may not have as many people listening quite as closely. I do think that it depends a little bit on how Ross frames the election and how Burr frames the election. He probably should frame it in terms of being on the Senate Intelligence Committee, chair of that committee, in terms of international security and terrorism. And from what I've seen so far, Ross isn't going to frame her campaign except in terms of North Carolina values, the old American dream, jobs, the economy. And so it'd be interesting to see the frames that they use and the narratives that they draw.
Well, Ken Rudin, the Democrats need to pick up, what, 4 seats to win
right.
back the Senate, or 5, depending upon how the presidential race goes.
Right.
So how do you rank this one in terms of the possibility of it flipping?
I don't see it happening right now. Of course, at this time in when Kay Hagan ran against Elizabeth Dole, I probably didn't see Hagan having a shot either. But Susan makes a very good point. Richard Burr and Jesse Helms are far from the same person, but I'm not convinced that Deborah Ross is a Kay Hagan as well. I don't know if she's going to raise as much money as Democrats have had in the past. I don't know if there's that much enthusiasm. And plus the fact, I don't know if Burr has done anything wrong or controversial that puts him up for defeat. Now, of course, top of the tickets can make things very difficult and dicey for incumbent senators. But I just think that Burr has kept his, you know, has kept his focus on North Carolina. His relationship with the leadership in the Senate is very, very strong. He's a strong ally of Mitch McConnell. I don't know if that's always good in many states, but at least he has a united party behind him. I don't see this. I mean, the numbers are very damning for the Republicans. Susan points out that 24 Democrats and 24 Republican seats, only 10 Democratic seats are up for grabs, and only 2 of the Democratic seats are considered vulnerable. But I just don't see at this point Burr being a top Senate race, contest to be watching for in November.
Well, let's go a little bit further down the ballot. And North Carolina elects a long ballot all the way down to labor commissioner and agriculture commissioner and state auditor and state treasurer. One of the races down ballot that's going to be open for the first time in more than a decade is attorney general, with Roy Cooper moving up to run for governor. Jarvis, we have Josh Stein, current state senator, mm-hmm. running on the Democratic side, and Buck Newton. Mm-hmm. running on the Republican side. What can you tell us about those candidates?
Well, I don't know much about Buck Newton. Josh Stein, I know a little bit about his career. He has been in the Senate for a while, viewed more or less as a progressive, somebody that has more or less paid his dues and made the right calls and the right steps along his political career, and probably is ambitious about doing some things above the attorney general's slot.
Yeah, so he's also a member of the legislature, Buck Newton.
Right.
So we have two members of the state Senate running for attorney mm-hmm. general. And then further down the ballot, the labor commissioner race is one that might get some attention this year. Cherie Berry is the incumbent Republican labor commissioner, but has been under some criticism from labor groups and from the News and Observer and the Charlotte Observer for basically some allegations that they are not doing a good enough job protecting laborers. And she has a strong opponent, Charles Meeker, who was the mm-hmm. longtime mayor of Raleigh. Mm-hmm. Do you see that being a competitive race?
I do. I think Charles Meeker is, of course, well known in the Raleigh area. He would have to make sure he has more name recognition around the state. Cherie Berry has the advantage of having her name in every elevator.
That's right.
In every
and
elevator
picture.
Throughout, and a picture throughout the state. And so name recognition will be very important there.
Yeah, one of the things Charles Meeker said, one of his campaign promises is he will not put his picture right. in elevators. Before we leave the topic of North Carolina primary, Susan, we should point out that the primary season isn't over here because there's going to be a congressional primary in June. And in fact, there were congressional candidates on the ballot yesterday. But if you cast a ballot for your member of Congress, it didn't count. So can you explain that situation?
Well, I think, and I'm not real sure about, it not counting was because the districts aren't really approved yet. I think that, I think it's a June primary, will have a minuscule turnout because it's not going to get the play and it's not going to get the visibility that March the 15th. I think you only had a lot of attention, and I may be wrong, to our primary is because it's been so competitive nationally. Because a lot of people just say, oh, when's the primary? This is going to be one of those elections. We're kind of the epicenter of confusion in terms of voter ID, in terms of what's going to happen this summer. So I'd expect a very low turnout. And I think that nobody knows really how they're going to be drawn. I think the conventional wisdom is they won't look a lot different. But I think that's going to be a race that, attracts very little attention.
Yeah,
and
it's
in the summer.
There are some new maps that have been drawn.
Yeah.
And they're still being contested, too. But one thing about the June 7th primary is, of course, for many college campuses, there'll be some students around in summer school, but a lot of them will be away.
We're talking politics. Ken Rudin, the political junkie, joining us from Washington. Thanks, Ken. Appreciate you being here.
Thanks a lot, Adam.
Susan Roberts, professor of political science at Davidson College. Thank you, Susan.
Thanks.
And here in the studio, Jarvis Hall, political science professor at North Carolina Central University. Thank you, Jarvis.
Thanks, Adam.
Just ahead, we'll preview an experimental theater production in Raleigh. It's called Beertown. Stay with us.